Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Jerk off to that all night long.
And with that, we open this episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmScoreRejects.com. This is the creepy crawly weekly exploitation filmcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am Brian Salisbury, and joining me on the other side of the studio, i.e. the living room, he is a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he is a lieutenant of Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
And I'm rocking the South by Southwest voice.
Smoking,
drinking, and karaoke apocalypse kind of does a number on the old pipes.
Yeah.
But this is a very exciting episode.
One of the most exciting episodes we've ever done. I'm super stoked for this for so many reasons, not the least of which being we are not alone in Casa del Worm today.
No, we have a special guest today, someone who you will know from a number of things. You might know him from Holliston. You may know many of his films, whether they be the junk food classics that we've talked about in the past, Wrong Turn 2, Knights of Badassdom, Everly. You will know him from our Modern Junk Food Masters episode, and he's here in town in South by Southwest, couch surfing at my place, with his new film that just premiered at South by Southwest, Mayhem, which is fucking awesome, Mr. Joe Lynch.
I was wondering if he was going to get done standing on that ceremony. Hello, Joe.
Hi, everybody. I too have South by Southwest voice, thanks to a multitude of stupid things. And also, I must say, I'm not couch surfing. I am box betting.
That is true.
Cargill has this amazing transformer-like box that turns into a bed, and it has been the 6 hours of sleep that I've gotten since I've been here Saturday have been the best 6 hours of sleep that I've gotten in a very long time. So thank you for that, sir.
No, at any time, brother.
Wow, those voices. I feel like I'm in a Tom Waits sandwich right now. And I'm the meat, which
like
makes
my favorite sex move ever.
Put the nitro back in the box. Guys, if you want to hear more musings like that about Transformer box beds and sandwiching yourself between Tom Waits and so on
plural.
And so forth. Plural. Tom Waits. Well, when you say Tom Waits plural, it's just ES, so it's still just Tom Waits.
Tom Waitai.
Tom Waity.
Could I be Tom Waits from Fisher King?
I would expect nothing less.
Okay, well, good, because I want to be the
Tom
bum
Waits
version.
From Fisher King, then I get to be Tom Waits from Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
And I get to be the Tom Waits on an Australian talk show when he proved to everyone that Heath Ledger stole his act for the Joker. That's the one I want to be, if possible. But you can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema if you want to throw shekels into the hat. But we don't have a lot of time to talk about that, because today we are continuing with our March Madness theme. Because March, and because crazy, and because psychic killers, qu'est-ce que c'est? We are talking about a film so nice that it was named twice. We are talking about Creepers, a.k.a. Phenomena.
Jennifer is the new girl in a strange school. She's taunted by her classmates, haunted by a deadly secret. And caught up in a murderous wave of terror.
When the murderer hides his victims, he likes to keep in physical contact with them.
But Jennifer's got a few million close friends.
Insects never hurt me. I love all insects.
You're in a position to do extraordinary things.
And she's going to need every one of them.
Do, 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 do.
Phenomena?
Do, 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 do.
Oh, Phenomena. And I hope you're as big a fan as John Travolta as we are, because we're going to cover this whole movie from start to finish.
Did you watch the wrong movie this week?
I may have.
This is the Jennifer Connelly, Donald Pleasance one.
Oh, this has no one gets powers because of cancer in this one?
That is correct.
Yeah, I watched the wrong movie.
You watched the wrong movie.
Oh, I also watched the wrong movie. I watched The Experts with Ari Gross. I probably should have brushed up.
Movie.
Damn it. I was way off.
So I'm super excited. We have talked about this film several times on the podcast.
You have shown this movie at the Draft House for your birthday.
This is one of my favorite movies. It is my favorite Argento.
I'm pleasantly surprised to hear, because this is not one of many people's favorite Argentos.
Except it's Argento's favorite Argento.
This is the one that he said was his most personal film, right?
Yes, it is his most personal film. It is his favorite amongst his films. And it's my favorite because it is so delightfully batshit insane and yet so well constructed at the same time, and does half a dozen things you've never seen before or since in a fucking movie.
Yeah.
It's just so fucking original and fresh and blows minds. And yes, I showed this at the Draft House. I showed Creepers at the Draft House. I had the choice between Phenomena and Creepers, and I showed Creepers.
Which is not a biography about Vincent Gallo, correct?
That is also.
Okay, good. Good to know.
No, but there's a reason.
Drive
why,
by.
And we'll talk about this, and that's part of what this episode is going to be about, is Phenomena is the movie you watch at 8 o'clock at night. Creepers is the movie you watch at midnight.
Yeah.
And because Creepers, these two movies are substantially different. One is 1 hour and 55 minute movie that is a film. And it is a long, lingering film with lots of long shots.
Lots of atmosphere.
Lots of development. And Creepers is like, we're getting in, we're getting out. And it is a fast, furious 82 minutes that when you finally get to the climax, which we cannot wait to talk about. And if you've not seen this movie, do not listen to the to this until you've seen one of these versions, or at least listen until we get to the big spoiler warning and then turn it off, pause it, watch the fucking movie and come back, because we are going to spoil the shit out of this ending, because this ending is one of the greatest, craziest, over-the-top endings in cinema history. And it also has the single best revenge subplot of any movie ever made.
This movie is so many things thrown together into one film. But I want to address, first of all, the fact that we're talking about this being an Argento film. And I've said this for years. This is the Argento film that feels most like Fulci of his entire catalog. When you watch this movie, if you were new to this game, but you knew there were three big names and you knew roughly what their styles were, and I made you watch this movie, you would 9 times out of 10 say it was Fulci, because, you know, and I thought a lot about this, because trying to nail down the difference between what a Argento movie looks like versus what a Fulci movie looks like, I think I finally figured it out. Basically, take the idea of crucifixion. In an Argento movie, the crucifixion is you walk into a big ghostly church, it's empty, you see the crucifix hanging up on the wall, and it's frightening, and it conjures images, and it's nightmarish, but that's about it. Meanwhile, while you're having this dream, you're actually being nailed to a piece of wood, because the Fulci movie is the actual crucifixion. It's the actual literal bolts and nails of the crucifixion and all of its bloody splendor, whereas Argento is more of the ephemeral and ethereal, dreamlike aspects of it. So whereas the image of crucifixion is an Argento movie, actually being crucified in real life is a Fulci movie.
And this movie straddles that line so deliciously. I just cannot. This movie likes to feel, it's very lofty at times. It's very cinematic. It's very much cinema. And then out of the blue, someone's head just gets chopped right off
and thrown into a waterfall. You know, you're just like, oh, okay, we're back into an Argento movie. Cause for a minute there, it was a Terrence Malick movie. and then wait, don't forget, we're actually, because there's a lot of moments, like we were watching it today. And when we were discussing this earlier, when we were having our porch talk, which should be, it's a podcast unto itself. I likened Creepers to be like the Shogun Assassin version of what Phenomena was, you know, where you can clearly tell, and, you know, you schooled me on so much more about this movie than I even knew. The fact that they were just getting to the nitty gritty, everything that you want with ultimately none of the atmosphere. So, it's understandable that it would be coming so fast and furious, and you lose a little bit of the tension, but at the same time, it's giving you every batshit crazy thing that you want in almost like an Argento mixtape. But it's funny, I never thought about that with the Fulci thing, you know, because you know, as a big Giallo fan myself, and, you know, when you have Argento and Fulci kind of in tandem as these two kind of masters, where Fulci is the, you know, the extreme close-up visceral master, whereas Argento will bask in a beautiful wide shot to let our, you know, let his damsel in distress walk through it. And you're dealing more with the mise-en-scene, giving you where the tension is, because you don't, and, you know, and obviously he's cascading it with all these beautiful colors at the same time, where Fulci's going like, you're going to just look at this shit right here, right now. And it's very confrontational. But this movie, more than a lot of the others, every time someone gets their head bashed into a window or a piece of glass, other than the first one, which is so lovingly slow-mo, it's like you sit there and you just go, even if it is a stunt person, this sucks.
Well, yeah, because they slow it down to the point that you see when the head is all the way back, it's falling down like stalactites into the person's face. And it's just like, that's got to hurt. I don't care if it's breakaway glass. That's got to hurt.
So, yeah, person gets stabbed, then through the glass, then the glass down on them, then gets their head cut off. And their head's tossed into a waterfall. And that's not the last time we see that head.
And I love that. I love that. Yeah. Heads up. It's coming back. God.
I forgot this wasn't called Dad Jokes, the podcast.
No, it. I've been doing dad jokes since before I became an actual dad. So I've been training my whole life. But I love the idea that he takes like all these beautiful scenic moments, and then he literally just throws a head into the river. It's the ultimate subversion of scenic, like you were saying, the Terrence Malick like loving scenery shots. It's like, oh yeah, that's pretty, isn't it? Here's a fucking skull in the water, and just
then,
because.
And then how about a beautiful rack focus on a fucking maggot crawling hand? This movie starts getting really gross.
We were talking about that shot before, and you're right. Like again, Fulci would take just so much care into those close-ups, where Argento would try to find, you know, whether it's using a glint of light, you know, or almost like a split diopter shot. And a lot, you know, like my favorite Argento movie is Deep Red, and the amount of times that he uses like that split diopter effect, which, you know, if you've seen a Brian De Palma movie, he uses it ad nauseum. But, you know, there's that scissor shot in the movie, you know, where I go, oh, that's a clear Argento shot, you know. But then you have that weird, you know, manual zoom, but it also using the like the racked focus to reveal that hand. And I was like, nobody does that anymore, you know, like, and the only guy that I could think of would be like David Fincher, you know, where he almost takes glee into the fetishization of like fucking South by Southwest of, you know, a disgusting icon, like a severed hand with maggots all over it. Plus, there's a lot of maggots in this movie. Has anyone noticed?
This is maybe one of the only movies I've ever seen to require in the credits a maggot wrangler, which I don't even know where you get one of those. Are they union? I feel like they would have to be union.
They actually are. There are maggot teamsters.
Okay, that's good to know. And also, I want you please do this, Joe. Anytime you get that obnoxious Q&A question about what you shot on, just to fuck with people, tell them you shot on a Deep Red, since that's your favorite Argento. Just tell them that you shot the whole movie on a Deep Red and see like if one or two people in the audience like, oh yeah, that's a good camera.
It's going to be one guy, and it's going to be like, that guy knows what's up. And, you know, like, and then we will probably have drinks later on. So,
like the roar joke you made last night.
I know. And you know what? There was one person who got that joke. And I know who that person is because they're lounging on a chair, a couch across from me, looking like Burt Reynolds in a podcast. You are the Burt Reynolds of podcasting.
Yeah, don't tell him that, please. No, he's going to ask for so much money. Don't put that idea in his head.
All right, damn it.
Well,
sorry.
I'm just going to have, you know, Hal Needham living in my guest house.
Actually, we should have done that a long time ago. That and if there is one podcast that understands only one person getting the joke, it's this show.
Stargrove.
That's all I'm saying. So the story of Phenomena, the actual plot, as we've been dancing around, basically, it's a very Argento plot. It's a young girl.
There is no just discussing the basic plot movie.
I don't think we were ever dancing around.
No,
there's three.
No, that's Suspiria where they're dancing.
There are three movies going on here.
That's the thing.
There is a serial killer movie. There is a version of Carrie.
Yes.
And there is a revenge plot. There is a revenge movie. They are all going on, and they are all more bug fuck versions, if you will permit me the dad joke.
Hey-o.
Of these movies. Like, this is, if you took any one of these plots out and made a full movie out of it, it would still be fucking batshit and not like anything else. You have never seen a movie where this type of revenge is gotten. You have never,
I love how you're holding off.
I'm holding off.
He wants to so bad. No, it's like it's edging for him.
Because you know what? That's what the movie does. The movie spends the entire time setting piece after piece after piece up, and it seems like needless exposition at times, and sometimes it's super wonderful exposition. And then the thing happens that you're like, no fucking way. But
it pays off.
It pays off, and everything is logical within this movie. Yeah. Like, I'm not saying it's a logical movie.
Because it's not. No. It's not even a dream logical movie like most of Argento's are. Yeah.
But every piece is put into play and then gets all cinched together at the end.
It's a very satisfying plot. If anything, I would say that this is the used cars of Argento movie.
Hot take!
But that was good. But if you think about like Zemeckis scale movies, you know, they are masters of knowing how to set stuff up without setting stuff up. And then when the payoff happens, the audience feels completely invested in the movie. They feel as smart as the filmmaker. You know, they're along for the ride. And so many things in Phenomena are, you don't even know that they're actual setups, i.e. the thing that you want to talk so much about but can't. That was the worst. I really hope you have an edit function on that
one. No, that was you swallowing the spoiler, so it's okay.
Yes, yeah. All right, perfect. Yeah. But those things that you don't... I mean, when I grew up and saw this movie, I saw it as Creepers because of that fucking crazy box,
the
which
DVD
is only promising you full force insect madness, you know, and Jennifer Connelly eaten in half, which, to be fair, was not delivered. And I was a little disappointed at the time because I'm like, that's pretty misleading.
False advertising.
Seriously.
But what we haven't mentioned yet, this is not only a Jennifer Connelly movie. This is her first leading role.
Yeah, it is indeed.
It is her second film. She had done it after Once Upon a Time in America, which she was only in for like 15 minutes.
15 glorious minutes.
Well, but in Once Upon a Time in America, that's like 2% of the movie.
Yeah, not even.
This is the movie she will not answer questions about in interviews. She had such a terrible time making this movie.
Well, when...
Yes. Oh, no.
Okay, I can't even say that. I can't even drop that tidbit of knowledge
yet.
You
can, because you know what? We're not spoiling anything. There is a monkey in this movie.
Yeah, and at one point,
I hope that you just call this the monkey episode, so it's right up front.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Monkey, you know.
Yeah,
help.
I mean,
monkeying around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Monkeying around with Phenomena.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, in parentheses, and that hairy guy,
and they're like, is he the monkey? Yeah. No, but I mean, when an ape who's a character in the movie bites part of your finger off and it has to be surgically reattached, which actually happened to Jennifer Connelly in this movie, I can understand why you have a few bad memories of Phenomena/Creepers.
When you are in a scene where you are dropped into a pit of maggots and start drowning in a pit of maggots.
She earns this paycheck, guys.
When you have to swim underwater and hold your breath that long for those long shots, these are all things that go, fuck that job.
And let us not forget, speaking of being along for the ride, you really need to be before the ending, because the ending will pay off all of your patience, but you have to be along for the ride with this movie, because at one point it literally turns into Harry and Tonto with her and a fly, where she's taking a bus ride with a fly, and the fly is leading her to a place that she needs to go.
So here's
bus trip with a fucking insect, guys.
Here is the basic rundown of this story. Girls are being killed by a serial killer at a private girls' school. And for some reason, the girls are scared at the girls' school, but nobody's really doing fucking much about it.
Also, all still very horny, too.
All still very horny. Then...
horny for that Richard Gere, am I right?
Oh, my God. And the Bee Gees. Culture explosion in that
scene.
Yeah,
I know. Oh, my God.
And then an American girl shows up whose father is a famous actor, and she's a little kooky. And as it turns out, she sleepwalks. And not only does she sleepwalk, she communicates with insects.
And here we have the thing that ties it into the theme of this month. She has the psychic ability to communicate with insects.
To see through their eyes and to influence their behavior and to actually communicate with them.
Now, I know you've applied for membership here at Xavier School for Gifted Children, Jennifer, but I'm not sure your power is really at all useful. You can talk to bugs. Okay, well, the West Coast Avengers are hiring. Maybe you should check with them.
Actually,
I'm sorry, Great Lakes Avengers. You're moving down the list.
I was going to say, it's more of a Great Lakes Avenger power than a West Coast Avenger power. But yes, that is what's going on. And then Donald Pleasance.
Yay!
Who is, you know what? We've been talking about this. He's a potential nominee for Mount Junk Food.
He's so close. He's so close. And if we don't put him on there, he's just going to hang around that mountain and be like, I should have been up there. I heard this podcast.
This has got to be the fourth or fifth.
That's a good question. Junk.
Thank you.
This has got to be the fourth or fifth movie we've covered of his.
Oh, my God. We need to do a dozen more.
We did Alone in the Dark. We did Halloween 4.
Mm-hmm.
I know we've done some others. But yeah, here he is, a world famous entomologist
with a completely unnecessary, but God love him for doing it, Scottish accent.
After finding this, what's the use of hiding from the fires? As a killer,
I love it so much.
You're right; they never really explain it.
Yeah, he's like
he's from Scotland.
I came.
That's it.
I'm not gonna try
take
to
take it or leave it.
Yeah, I'm not gonna try to do Pleasance with a Scottish accent, but his explanation is I came here for school and then I just decided to stay and teach. Which is here's the craziest part of this though, and another thing that's never explained. It's not. 15th craziest thing about this movie. He is an entomologist. He teaches entomology at this girls' school in Switzerland. Fine, okay. But he's apparently also the physician because the first time she goes out and has an episode, he's the one examining her. He's a bug doctor, and he's examining her as if he's also the school's physician. I want to know what his actual degree is in. Look, I want to see those papers.
If Jeremy Piven can be a doctor and he's really a veterinarian in Heat, I can accept that.
Wow. That's a good point.
It's just, look, is there a doctor in the house?
Your sentence could have ended with, look, if Jeremy Piven,
was in anything.
If it was just the end of that sentence, I would have been like, you know what? That's a valid point, my statement.
It never bothered me, though, because it was just like, well, of course, he's a doctor.
Yeah, doctor with a capital D.
Yes.
Undefined doctor.
But he's also a doctor in a wheelchair. And because as a result of him being in a wheelchair, he needs help around the house. So he has a helper monkey.
And also a fancy spruced up version of Mrs. Deagle's elevator thing.
So he has
Deagle 2000.
And whenever he clicks, he guides the monkey around. Not only can the monkey understand English, but he guides the monkey around with a red laser clicker.
Can we please, I'm going to pitch you guys a television show called Undefined Doctor starring Donald Pleasance and his helper monkey companion. And they go around and they solve mysteries that require of different degrees that we learn every week that he has or maybe doesn't. We're not sure.
And the various children that he meets that have psychic power.
Yes. So it's like Catch Me If You Can, where he's just pretending to have all these doctorates, but he's just good at being weird enough to make all of it work. And through all of the psychic companionships, the mysteries get solved. Undefined Doctor, Thursdays at 8 on NBC.
So Stephen J. Cannell Productions, and you see him fly the paper up at the end.
So
it's a big hit.
Wow.
Our psychic girl ends up having her roommate killed because she is accidentally, while sleepwalking, witnessed the killer. She's trying to unlock the memory. She can't do it. But the killer has seen her. Her roommate accidentally puts on her shirt when sneaking out to hang out with her boyfriend. Killer is stalking her, thinks it's her, kills her, murders her. And when she goes outside, when Jennifer goes outside, because she is Jennifer Connelly playing Jennifer, when Jennifer goes outside,
we need to talk about that real quick, because the same fucking thing happened in The Rocketeer, and there was this rumor, and everyone said it was bullshit, where they changed the name of the character in the comics from Betty to Jenny because Jennifer Connelly wasn't good at remembering any other person's name when she was playing a character, and everyone's like, oh, that's just mean, there's no way that's true, and yet in her first movie, she's also named Jennifer. There's starting to be credence.
Maybe that's why they said that.
Starting to be credence to this, but why change it from Betty to Jenny if you're casting Jennifer Connelly, if it's not that? That's my question. I'm just asking questions.
Because Betty from the Block doesn't sound as good.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point.
So we actually, Betty from the Block sounds pretty great, actually. I don't know what you're
talking about. Hey, I heard that laugh in the background. Don't peanut gallery.
So she goes out to find her friend dead, and she's led to the body by a firefly. And she's really weirded out by the experience. She goes to talk to Donald Pleasance, meets the helper monkey, becomes friends with Donald Pleasance, and Donald Pleasance eventually figures out that she has psychic powers to control bugs.
I met this 15-year-old girl with several eyes, like a fly's eyes. She could see everything at once.
So.
Oh, it's going to happen like 10 more times. Don't look at me like that's going to stop. So, it's not going to stop.
No, I knew doing a Donald Pleasance movie, we were going to get the Donald Pleasance.
I did that joke 6 times. The evil is not gone from here.
So,
you're never going to finish the plot.
I'm never going to. No, have you listened to the podcast?
Yes, but now I get it.
Yeah, now you've seen it live. You're like, this is not scripted. This is literally.
You need to take this on the road, seriously. But you have to bring the couch.
And a helper monkey and a fly in a box.
I often talk about the fact that I lay on the couch and while I'm doing this. And Joe thought I was kidding. That we are really in some nice studio somewhere, not really in my living room.
And it's in his contract. It's a weird writer.
Oh, my God.
So now she is dead set on finding this killer, and Donald Pleasance teaches her how to use various types of bugs to track the killer. And so now we have a 15-year-old girl trying to track down a killer. And when the killers figure out that these people know and are close to closing in on them, they start killing everyone off.
Yeah, in rapid succession. And you're right, this is three movies packed into one. This has so many subplots going on that if they happened to converge at a diner where Tim Roth was holding the place up, you wouldn't bat an eye. And oh, look, there's John Travolta again. You're in the wrong phenomenon. Get the fuck out of here.
But they do converge in a wonderful, crazy bug fuck climax.
Yes.
That we are now going to talk about. So from this point on,
spoiler warning.
If you have not watched it, and we have not sold you on the idea of watching a movie where a psychic Jennifer Connelly controlling bugs is tracking down a serial killer,
psychic
Jenny Pleasance with a helper monkey,
why are you listening to the show?
So,
did you just have a Lego movie moment? You were just like, you know, what's funny is while you were taking your sweet time and explaining this movie. I kept thinking, what is the elevator pitch for this movie? And you just did it. Like, that was it.
That's it.
Like, that at least got me to the third floor. And I'm going, yes, I want to watch this movie when I get out of the elevator with this creepy dude who's telling me about this fucked up movie. This sounds amazing.
Would you like a handful of bugs?
Bugs.
So, here we have it. And so what ends up happening, oh, glorious listeners?
Do you remember at the end of Cabin in the Woods, when they push a button and everything just gets let out at once, and you realize that all these different horror movies just showed up?
That's the last 15 minutes of this
movie. That's the last 15 minutes of this fucking movie.
Yes.
Without Bradley Whitford,
so, when Donald Pleasance gets killed, that triggers one of my favorite elements of this fucking movie, because the killer is there. He can't see the killer. He's stuck on his
Eagle chair.
Yeah. And he clicks the light as the monkey is going nuts, trying to get in, knows the killer's in there. The monkey is trying to go and save Donald Pleasance. The monkey can't get in. She's tearing apart the window and the blinds and trying to get in. And he clicks the clicker on the killer. And we get this brilliant shot of a laser in the eye. And the clicker is telling the monkey what it's supposed to be doing. So when the killer murders Donald Pleasance and he has lit it up with the laser, that sets up the monkey chasing the killer.
Oh my God. It's like the coins in Game of Thrones. Like anything he clicks that laser onto will get killed by this fucking monkey.
And the monkey, there is a fucking car chase where a monkey is on top of a car trying to get into the car and kill the killer. And gets thrown off the car.
Now, the one thing that like hasn't really been discussed is, if you haven't seen this movie and you're thinking maybe this is a movie that has been made now, more likely than not, you would be seeing like an amalgam of like real monkey shots, some animatronic monkey, you know, puppet for, you know, a majority of scenes, and possibly some CG.
Oh, Andy Serkis is on top of that fucking van in a heartbeat if they remake this
movie. Exactly. And 90% of everything that you just described and throughout the film is a real monkey. That moment when the monkey is trying to like warn her master about the killer coming in and she's tearing the windows apart, it's actually heartbreaking because especially now when you know about like all the different rules and all the regulations that you have with animals, this monkey gives a tour de force performance, but this monkey performance would probably never happen today.
I honestly, the more I watch this movie, the more I'm like, yeah, I kind of side with the monkey and the whole finger biting situation, because they put this monkey and actually, to be fair, they put both the monkey and Jennifer Connelly through the ringer. It's a matter of time before one of them snaps.
It's why that final shot is actually so kind of fucking touching.
It shows that she's in a brilliant fucking actress, because she probably want to wring that monkey's neck.
Right.
Or was it then that it happened? Does anyone know when?
It's in that final sequence.
Yeah, it's in that last shot when they're walking away.
Because the monkey kept wanting to turn around. And so Argento said, don't let the monkey turn around. Put your hand on the monkey and force the monkey to stay turning. And the monkey got so irate at her, she snapped at her finger and took her finger off.
That's right. And then afterwards, the monkey went to its trailer, and then the producer took like, 3 hours to try to coax the monkey out of the trailer from
it
there?
They had to call Joel Silver to get a big bag of monkey cocaine.
They needed an 800-pound gorilla of its own to come in.
Wait for moments to mention Joel Silver so you can do your coke impression.
I'm going
to
do coke with a monkey! I'm going to do coke with a monkey!
That is a really good Joel Silver.
Thank you.
Holy
So, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
All in this movie.
So, we've got a cop who's on the trail as serial killer who finally figures it out and shows up. We find out that the serial killer is actually a young man with dwarfism who looks like a child until the end, but has this actual disease, I forget what it's called, this actual syndrome or something that distorts
Stendhal syndrome, possibly.
It's called Patau syndrome, and the character's name is Patau in the movie as a reference to that syndrome.
And so he's been murdering girls.
He doesn't have a nose.
He's been murdering girls, and his mother has been covering it up. And his mother has been doing the other killings. And so this leads to the cop showing up, finding their corpse pit where the bodies of the severed pieces of these girls are being digested by fucking maggots.
You know, in Texas, nobody has basements, which I find really disappointing, because where the hell are you supposed to put a corpse pit if not in the basement?
Well, and then we get a crazy fucked up sequence in which Jennifer Connelly ends up in the maggot pit, covered in fucking maggots. We end up with the cop chained up to the wall. He breaks his own hand to slip out of the handcuff to try to strangle. Yeah.
This is where it goes full Fulci.
To try to strangle the woman. Jennifer Connelly escapes, gets off into a boat to try to get away. She gets chased by the dwarf, who starts trying to kill her. Jennifer Connelly is freaking the fuck out, summons every fucking insect for miles.
What an amazing goddamn shot.
That swarm in and then swarm the dwarf, eating him alive, forcing him to claw his own fucking face off.
Full Fulci, folks.
Yeah. Goes off into the water, and she's safe. And she tries to start the engine, and the engine blows up and catches on fire, and she has to jump into the water as the boat explodes.
A lake of fire, basically.
And then it's gas everywhere, and now she's swimming underneath the lake of fire. And just as she's about to get out from the lake of fire, the dwarf is back.
Here comes Jason Dwarfies to pull her back under the water.
And so she finally wrestles away from him. She swims to shore.
Is that what got you? Sorry.
He pops up in the fire and burns to death, as if this evil asshole hasn't suffered enough.
Man.
And then we have these long, lingering shots of her. Finally, she's free. She goes up onto shore. And then the guy she's been waiting to show up the whole movie.
By the way, her white knight, the cavalry, is going to be not her dad, who has been sort of AWOL throughout this whole movie. Her dad's agent.
Yes.
Like, if there was a more, like, fuck you to L.A. that I've ever heard in a movie, it's that this whole time she's talking about her dad and how much she loves her dad. And the guy who comes to save her is her dad's agent because her dad's too busy.
And then he gets decapitated running towards him because mom's not dead. Mom killed the cop. Fuck you guys. We've got another ending.
Pamela Dwarfies.
And so she she gets the upper hand on Jennifer Connelly. Jennifer Connelly isn't summoning bugs now, and just as she's about to take this sharp piece of metal and sever her fucking head, the monkey's back with a razor! The razor from the beginning of the movie that he was told it's dangerous and it can hurt. Look, it cuts, and the monkey takes a razor, a fucking straight razor. And
dude, it's Chekhov's monkey razor. Chekhov's monkey razor. If you see a monkey with a razor in the first act, that monkey's going to kill somebody at the end of the movie.
And you know what? That's actually what it is. Yeah. That is what it, you do not show a monkey how to use a razor. If you're not going to have the final scene, have the monkey with a straight razor.
Come here, I must teach you about storytelling.
When I showed Creepers at my screening, everyone jumped to their feet and cheered and were just like the audience did not see that moment coming. And it was just a hell yeah moment. And everyone's like, holy shit, the movie went there. And it's really the monkey with a straight razor that is clearly dulled, fucking hacking away at an actress.
He's getting in there. He's
got to defend herself from him. It's a real monkey fucking hacking at an actress. Like, how fucking dangerous is this?
Isn't it true that in most cases, in most of his movies, that Argento's hands were the ones that was the killer, right? Isn't that like the common...
That would make all of the sense in the world to me. And I do like that about this movie. And it's funny, as I hear us describing it and I hear the things said out loud that actually happen in this movie... It sounds like an awful movie. It sounds like a terrible movie. Turns out it's made really, really well. And one of the things that really works about this movie are the classic giallo elements, including the gloved hands of the killer, the glinty, sharp blades.
Yeah, the kick on the scissors or whatever the implement is used.
The first person POV. Like, there's a lot of classic giallo elements. And at the end of the movie, he just unleashes three different endings to three different movies that somehow all work.
Yeah.
Do you think that maybe it might have been like Clue, where maybe he just shot three separate endings thinking maybe one would work, and then he just said, fuck it, just throw it all in there at the same time. Why not?
Whoa. I don't know. This was, now reportedly, this was when he was still on heroin, and this was his last movie on heroin, which is why he was just deep in the throes. At this point, he was Ozzia. He was, you know, just like, yeah, Ozzia, you go and hang out in Rome. You're 9 years old. You're old enough to wander the streets. He was completely.
Yeah, go Rome if you want to. You're welcome. I wish people at home could see Stargrove. I wish people at home could see the way that Cargo closes his eyes and just tries to bear through and get to the end of this episode.
Now, seeing it live,
right?
I get it.
He hates me.
I get it. I see why there's so much distance between you two.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's hard to swat someone upside the back of the head from over here.
Yeah, that's why I sit here.
Yeah. But so Argento. This is his weirdest, wildest, just bug fuck movie. And it just works. And it's also very personal. And here's the thing. Here's the difference. Now I'd like to get into this. The difference between Phenomena and Creepers. Phenomena loses a quarter of a movie. And it's a lot of the deeper stuff, and it's a lot of the slower stuff. It takes away one kill because the kills are repetitive or early in the movie. You know, it's a girl is wanders into a place, gets killed. You don't really need more than one of those. And they take out the MRI sequence, which is where they're testing her, because that just doesn't, you know, that's not needed for the story.
Well, and talk about a leap. When they're like, well, you know, sleepwalking could lead to schizophrenia. It could be another personality trying to get out. And it's like, who is writing this research? I know. It's undetermined Dr. Donald Pleasance. That's who's writing all these papers that say things like sleepwalking leads to schizophrenia. Well, he's not a psychologist.
Yeah. And one of the biggest cuts
in this movie,
is that they cut the speech that Jennifer Connelly gives 15 minutes into Phenomena, which is the true story of Argento's mother leaving him and his father on Christmas Day.
Which, speaking of gremlins, by the way, Joe, feels like a Phoebe Cates moment, because it's right at the beginning of the movie.
Big time.
And it's right after a very silly thing happens. And then it's like, and this girl, they pack an entire friendship into a 5-minute scene, because it's like, what's your name? What's your greatest fear? How did your mother leave? Like, it just keeps going. I was like, whoa, can we wait till tomorrow to really get into the heavy stuff? I just
really
met you.
Speed plotting through all of that, like that character development, if you will.
Which makes sense.
You know, Paul Corvino, have you gone to bed with him?
No. That's my dad.
My dad. Paul Corvino, yeah, my dad, you know, just in case.
But see, that's the thing is that's, you know, this is a personal movie for Argento. Not only is he talking about his own mother abandoning him on Christmas Day, he's also making a movie about being famous, someone who's famous and off making movies and abandoning their daughter and not being connected to their daughter, which is what the Argentos went through. So this is very personal on both sides. It's Argento talking about not only his own pain of his mother leaving, but it's also him talking about how bad a father he is and creating this fantasy version of a daughter and creating this this unbelievably crazy fucking structure of a movie.
Yeah. And speaking of alternate endings and alternate versions of this movie, I have to confess that I have a very specific form of memory loss. It's a weird aphasia that every time I watch this movie, I always remember that the monkey killed everybody. That it's like a Murders in the Rue Morgue situation where the monkey was to blame for all of the deaths. And then I watch it and I'm always surprised by, oh no, the monkey just gets the revenge kill at the end. The monkey's the hero. Because for a while I was like, I'm pretty sure this movie is actually called Phenomena, Creepers, and Any Which Way But Murder. Because I think it's the chimpanzee the whole time.
Wow. But it's not. And in fact, that's what's great is the monkey is the hero at the end. And then there's this touching hug.
The monkey stuff, that's what's crazy about it. And that's why you can't.
The monkey's a real character. Yeah. There are only two movies that I know of where the monkey is more of a character than it is the focus.
Yeah.
Like you have something like Project X, which we'll talk about later.
If you're going to mention Dunstan right now, I'm in total agreement with you. And no. I think, no.
Okay. No. I'm actually going to mention a potential junk food future.
Take a drink.
Anaconda. Hunt for the Blood Rose or
Blood Orchid.
Blood Orchid.
I shouldn't know that.
That's
not a thing I should know.
There is a character. There is a monkey in that movie named Kong, and that monkey is the captain's monkey. And there is an actual brilliantly shot, brilliantly executed horror sequence in which the monkey is off the boat trying to get back to the boat and the anaconda is hunting it. And you are more terrified for Kong than you are any other character in that fucking movie. And that's partly how this feels. Like this monkey, you feel for this monkey. This monkey is so adorable and lovable and such a sweet character. And when that monkey shows up and gets her just revenge, it is so satisfying. It's like, and then when Jennifer Connelly hugs the monkey, it's so sweet. And it's like, these two have been through the shit together. Yeah. Like these two have been through such shitty things and they're safe and they have each other now. And it's such a sweet, wonderful, delightful ending to an otherwise mean and ugly and gross and
at times literally ugly. Like they take the idea of an ugly graphic Fulci movie and project it out to a point where the killer is this hard to look at, you know, dwarf in a mask, and it's just you can't look at it. It's so ugly. But like you said, Inga, the monkey character, is so fucking lovable. And the way that there's literally a shot in this movie where they walk into Donald Pleasance's office and Inga is sitting in a chair more like a human than Donald Pleasance is sitting in his chair.
And they don't even really they shoot it in a way where it's not like, look, there's a monkey in the chair. It's just monkeys.
It's a three shot.
Yeah, it's a master and the monkey is hanging out. And not even like if you watch animal starring movies often, there's a lot of like little tell moments where you can tell like there's a trainer like right off the camera or something we were talking about before. A lot of times in like animal movies, and I know this because now my kids have watched Beverly Hills Chihuahua 3 about 400 times.
You're a brave man.
I'm a tortured man. But this is a technique that they've done a lot for animal films. It's called rock and rolling, and it's an edit technique where, you know, if you have a shot that's 2 seconds long, if you have the motion go, you know, all the way to the end and then reverse it, if you do it in the right motion and with the right, like, little subtle technique, it actually extends the motion for the animal because you can only get an animal to do, you know, something so long. This movie has like the record of like wide shots where an animal is doing a complex acting moment, like the moment with the kite. Like the monkey has to run in, grab the kite, look back at the house, and run off to the house. That's a lot of like, yeah. They're called beats. It's like stunts, you know, like the stunts have beats and animals have, you know, specific beats. Fuck you, South by. And, and those are really complex. Sometimes they have multiple trainers.
And it's really hard. Like, I remember on Sinister, the night we had the dog.
Vincent D'Onofrio. That's right. He had a clicker, right? Like,
they put some peanut butter in his mouth so that he would talk.
Delicious. Delightful. D'Onofrio. No, but no, we have a scene with a dog, and we're the first shot. We're ready. We've got to get the dog to stare in the camera and growl. That's it. Dog stare in the camera and growl. Scott calls action, and the dog sits down. And me and Scott bust out laughing, and Ethan just turns to us and just goes, "Keep laughing. Just keep laughing." Then I'm going to tell you the stories that I went through shooting White Fang.
I was going to say fucking White Fang.
And we got a whole night of stories of, this is just the beginning, my friend. Like, this is going to be... And it took us a couple hours to get just the right shots of this dog standing and growling. So to have an animal do these complex actions is impressive as fuck. And no wonder that monkey was angry.
Had himself some Connolly fingers for dinner. Yeah. And you know what, Cargill, you should have used that rock and rolling technique that Joe was talking about, which I believe was invented by the French cinematographer Monsieur Ed. If you've ever seen his television show, he actually does that quite a bit.
It was actually best used in the film Hot to Trot.
Oh, dear Christ. Dear Christ. You're not wrong.
No, I'm not wrong. I hate that's a...
All right,
half of Hot to Trot is in reverse.
You know what?
That's just Bobcat's performance.
Which, yes. We have brought up plot names and devices from Anaconda sequels, and Hot to Trot is still the deepest track of the evening, so congratulations, Joe.
Indeed.
Yeah, I have trouble with multiplication tables, but I can remember fucking Hot to Trot. Good job, Brian. You're a grown-up now. Holy moly. But I want to highlight one thing that you can often say about an Argento movie, but maybe more so in this movie than any, the fucking score. As it should be.
With some Iron Maiden.
Yes!
Some Motorhead.
This turns into fucking demons at one point.
Gang. Yeah,
it turns into demons where it's like all of a sudden you have a heavy metal soundtrack mixed with a goblin score. It's very much like the ending of this movie where he just lets loose and everything is being thrown at you and it works in a way that should not fucking come together.
Most of the time. So I would argue there's one sequence where it doesn't really work.
The ambulance scene?
The ambulance scene.
It just felt like they just went like, oh shit, we have one more track to go. Just throw it in there.
Yeah, where they're bringing out Donald Pleasance and we're rocking out.
Oh, yeah, no, that's a good point. No, I'll give you that.
Yeah, it's like that's the one real musical misstep I feel is in this movie. Because it's like, that's not the mood of the scene at all. The other scenes, like when girls are getting chased and fucking guitars start chugging and the drums start beating. Yeah, I remember you turn to me and you're like, this shouldn't work.
No.
But it totally fucking works.
All that percussion, it feels like they're about to break out into like a 70s musical number like Hair or something like that. Like all of a sudden fucking Naked Treat Williams is going to come out and it's just like dominate the scene. But it does work. And you know, it's funny. I'm glad that you brought up demons because, you know, we were talking about Fulci and Argento. And, you know, obviously people talk a lot about like Mario Bava, but like not many people talk about Lamberto Bava, who directed Demons. And this movie feels more like Demons at times, especially with the music. And even like Bava's movies to me felt like they like, or even, you know, like I'm going to screw his name up, like Michel Soavi. You know, like with Stage Fright and The Church and everything. They feel like they are the progeny of these two masters with Demons, with a little heavy metal like thrown in. Whereas I got to admit, when you watch Phenomena, it almost feels like Argento turns to someone and says, what do the kids like?
Yes, it really does.
I need to throw this in because I need to feel relevant.
And that scene, that yeah, is
sorry,
never...
he started to sound like Guillermo del Toro.
A little bit.
My bad.
You not enough fucks.
You fucking cocksucker. Show me the kids.
By the way, I love that you mentioned Suave because The Church is a movie I have been beating the drum for years and saying should be the unofficial Demons 3 because so much of that movie feels like another Demons sequel. Mm-hmm. And they actually ended up slapping a different movie with a Demons 3, kind of the way... they're Italians and the Italian film market is... if it made money in America, pretend it's that. But I don't remember where I was going because I got off on a Suave tangent. But
Demons, the rock and roll.
Demons, the rock and roll.
Rock and roll Demons.
Rock and roll Demons, which is, of course, a TV show I'm working on with Donald Pleasance and a helper monkey. Don't worry about it. Every show I pitch is going to have Donald Pleasance and a demon monkey. But yeah, that score, as soon as she walks in the house at the very beginning of the movie, she's just like, hello. And in any other movie, it'd be like maybe some, you know, Manfredini tones or like...
Spooky atmosphere.
But no, this is just like, it's like a fucking action scene is about to break out and it should not work. But it does.
It really does.
But don't you think that that's most of Goblin's work, especially with Argento? Like, even when you have a moment like when Goblin did the cues for Dawn of the Dead... You know, and they're, you know, the scene when they're running down through the mall and it's like, bow, bow, waka, 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 waka. And it feels more like an episode of Columbo than it should actually be something that with the stakes this high. And yet it works. Like, I got lucky enough to go see Goblin, live at the Egyptian a couple of years ago.
Nice.
Front row center. And it plays like a rock show. But what they do is they play scenes from, all the movies in the background just to give you a little bit of like flavor and context and everything. And again, like you watch them, and the second that the drums kick in, there's almost like a knee jerk reaction where you go like no, like we're supposed to be moody and you know and more ethereal and where the you know like why am I want to dance to the beat of this these deaths and it fucking works. Like I wonder how he came to that conclusion and then somehow rolled the dice because not many other filmmakers, you know, unless it's more of like an homage sort of way or a retro sort of way, a lot of films don't employ percussion in, you know, in those moments. Otherwise it's more like a taiko drum sort of thing. Like, are there other movies like that, that use that kind of snappy Goblin-esque music, not in a retro sort of way that works? Because I can't think of too many.
Well, the one that I can think of immediately that actually kind of emphasizes the point that you're making, but does it takes the music and does something completely different with it that also works, is in Shaun of the Dead. When they use that Dawn of the Dead...
Well, the Queen song, you know.
The Queen song for sure, but that Dawn of the Dead track that you're talking about when they're in the mall, mm-hmm. they use in Shaun of the Dead when he's explaining like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go to the Lizzie's, we're going to go to the... And it's such a fun... But it that works. Moment is very and kinetic.
If you know? Didn't know the cue, like I'm sure... 60% of the people who saw Shaun of the Dead would not know or have that like knee-jerk reaction like, oh my God, they're using a Shaun of the Dead cue. And it's a funky beat that propels the action. In a comedy, though, like it works purely because the stakes are, you know, what they are with Shaun of the Dead. And you already know that there's a comedic tone. In Dawn of the Dead, you know, even though it's, you know, it's considered a satire, that's not a comedy beat. You know, like the stakes are still very high.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, like it's interesting to think that like Phenomena is one of those movies that and all of Argento's movies is really progressive with the way that they use music and in a way that I don't think other people can replicate.
I want this soundtrack and the score together on one vinyl from Mondo so bad I can taste it. And speaking of my specific aphasia, I just remembered the point I was going to make earlier, which was you said it feels like Argento saying, what do the kids like? The scene in the, I don't know if it's an English class or a literature class or whatever, is the most mishmash of kids from different generations and different affinities. There's one kid wearing a homemade Bee Gees shirt in 1985. Who is obsessed with the Bee Gees, who literally is like, what does this poem mean? I don't know. It sounds like Bee Gees lyrics, and everyone laughs. But then later in that same scene, by the way, this movie is really obsessed with Wagner. They mentioned Wagner like 5 times.
Well, that's because the house that they're staying in
was full of collaborators.
Was on no? Wagner's estate.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. But at one point she says, what about the classics? What about Shakespeare? What about Richard Wagner? And a girl stands up and goes, Richard Gere! And everyone laughs. And I'm like, What generate? Was there? Is this like a Terminator situation where some of these kids were like sent back in time or forward in time, and they're some of them are robots?
No, no. At this time, Richard Gere was a sex symbol.
Yeah, no, I get that. But then in the same room is a girl who's obsessed with a band who hadn't been popular in almost a decade.
No. No, first of all, in almost a decade, no, in less than a decade. They were very popular in the late 70s, early 80s. But keep in mind, this is also Europe. And this is also the same period, the same region of the world that thinks David Hasselhoff is one of the biggest stars in the world. So the Bee Gees probably were still doing very well there.
So it's like Canada, where they didn't get the 80s until 1992.
Yes. Right.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. That makes so much sense.
It really is. Like, you got to keep in mind, this is a European movie, and Europeans have a very different sense of pop culture than we do. We Americans get tired of shit real quick. We're just like, I liked your last album, but we're done with you. Whereas, like, in Europe, someone like David Hasselhoff can have a 25-year music career. Like, it's fucking crazy.
And God love him for it. And speaking of clashing cultures, if you track down this movie, don't be afraid of the fact that throughout the film, people will be speaking English, and then Italian, and then German.
No, now this is on the cut that is on Netflix, or not Netflix, on Amazon Prime right now. Has that version has these weird moments where they didn't dub it.
They didn't dub it or subtitle
it. But that's not, if I remember correctly, that is not a problem on the original DVD release of Phenomena. And it's certainly not a problem in Creepers. But if you stream this on Amazon right now, there's two or three moments where just the scene drops out and isn't in English anymore inexplicably.
There's a scene where Jennifer Connelly herself, who is said to be American about 27 times in this movie, just launches into Italian when a woman on a bus asks her to close the window. I know just enough Italian to know that's what she was telling her to do.
Or when those two guys were getting really rapey with her in the car.
Yeah, and they were getting really rapey, and she's speaking Italian. They were initially speaking German, so I don't know what the fuck she's doing speaking Italian all of a sudden. It is bizarre, but it is probably the version that most people listening to this are going to watch. Yes. So be forewarned.
Yes, but it literally only happens like three times in the movie.
And you will think
God, of course. Yeah, only three times.
Only three times.
Heroin's a hell of a drug.
Yeah. You, speaking of 800-pound gorillas, am I right? You will think that you have gone fucking insane before you get to the part of the movie that wants you to feel like you've gone fucking insane because of the language is just drifting in and out. And one of my favorite shots in the movie, speaking of things that are just crazy, is where the detective, because it's a giallo movie, so we have to have a detective show up. He ends up going to the house where this teacher at the school is like, oh, I'm going to get you to your dad's agent because apparently that's your legal guardian or some shit. Don't worry.
What fucked up relationship is going on there? Holy
shit.
That's
the beauty of it.
That's like, probably that's the Argento like,
that's
thing what
again. That's one of the things that I really, really love about this movie is not only, it's not just a movie of let's do crazy shit and make a crazy horror movie. This is very personal for Argento. Mm-hmm. He is nakedly admitting to his feeling of detachment from his mother when she walked out and his feelings for having pretty much abandoned his daughter.
I've abandoned my child. Speaking of detachment, not detached from the wall.
What a segue,
right?
Holy shit.
This is the show of segues, which is funny because this movie doesn't need them. But when Jennifer Connelly gets to the basement, there's a great scene where she's crawling through this tunnel and you just see these hands reach out and grab her and you realize it's that detective who's now been chained to the wall because he's fallen into the clutches of this evil woman. And it's such a great turn because at this point you still don't know what the fuck is going on. And then they push her into, as we said before, the corpse pit, which, I'm not going to cry plagiarism, but like I've seen Poltergeist. And that, I was watching her like writhing around in there and I was like, you moved the corpse pit, but you didn't move the bodies.
Why?
The most interesting episode of Coach you will ever watch in your entire life.
Yeah.
But it's shot immaculately. Yeah. This movie, like the shot compositions, I mean, apart from a couple of weird moments of editing, the shot compositions are just fucking gorgeous. And I think that there is, like I said before, an intentional subversion of that where he shoots things beautifully and then literally throws a head in the river or throws Jennifer Connelly, who he photographs like she is an angel on earth, and then throws her into a vat of slime and viscera. Like, there is an intentionality to, I am going to show you something so beautiful and then pull you down into the muck and drag you through the worst horrors you can possibly imagine. And I can see Fulci watching this and going, damn, bro. Damn.
And great shots. One of the best shots in the movie is when Jennifer Connelly is emerging from the water and walking out in that white dress lit by moonlight.
With the reflection, too. It's a stunning moment.
For some reason, fire and everything. For some reason, not carrying Excalibur like I feel like she should be, but, you know, whatever.
That's also not giving a care in the world, she seems. It's just kind of like, my work is done here.
Yeah, but it's very much like Alice at the end of Friday the 13th, where she's just like, oh, I'm just peacefully
gonna brush my finger across the water.
Nobody just hangs out after something like that. That's a horror thing that doesn't happen in the real world. But again, that's the difference between Argento and Fulci, is that Argento is the dream you have while you're being crucified, and Fulci is you actually being crucified. And this movie is like somewhere in between those two. And it also has one of my favorite Donald Pleasance performances. And that's saying something, because especially in this genre, there is a fuck ton of great Donald Pleasance to choose from.
There really is.
Oh, I met this monkey with the reddest ass, like a Jolly Rancher ass. Which, hey, brings us to the junk food pairing.
Great.
See that? Segues all day, day.
Well, before we get to the junk food pairing, I want to ask you guys. You're on a desert island. You can only have...
Together?
Take our pants off.
You can only have either creepers or phenomena to watch. Which version do you take with you?
What format are we watching this on?
Blu-ray.
Oh, okay. You go first?
Well, thank God my Samsung survived the crash, but not my water filter. I guess I got to go with phenomena. I mean, that's the version I prefer. And it because there's two versions of it, my weird form of aphasia, it'll seem like a new movie every time I watch it, like Leonard.
After watching Phenomena today, and after careful consideration, about 30 or so seconds, I would actually go with Creepers. And the reason why, and I, you know, and this, we've had this discussion beforehand, but I do subscribe to it now. I think that I get more of the greatest hits of the things that I love about Argento in a much more condensed sort of way, and very much like a theater owner, I'm going to get more plays a day.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get like at least about 10, you know, runs of Creepers a day. Whereas you're going to be stuck in your little fucking corner watching Creepers or Phenomena. What? Seven?
Just drinking my own piss.
Seven, you know, so I'm going to get more awesome monkey ass revenge shit than you are a day. So
literally monkey ass and revenge shit.
I'm with you. I love both versions. I think there's the 8 o'clock version of the movie and then the midnight movie, but I think this plays better as a midnight movie. It's the, as much as I like the Argento dealing with the shit with his own mother, and as much as I like some of the long lingering wandering that happens in this movie, you kind of just want to get into it, and you kind of want it because it's a brisk 82 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like, you start and next thing you know, a monkey is fucking slashing a woman, the villain to death. So that's the version that I turn to most. That's why I rewatched Phenomena today, because I haven't watched it in a couple of years, because whenever I sit down to watch it, I'm like, fuck it, I'm going to watch Creepers, because I usually want to watch it in the middle of the night and had a few drinks, and it's like, fuck it, let's watch Creepers.
See, I thought your question was going to be Desert Island, you only had one Argento or one Fulci, but you went super specific with it. Like, if that question was its own movie, it'd be Under Siege 2, Esso Territory.
And before we get to the junk food pairing...
I'm breaking Joe. I love this.
I know.
When you see it live and you see the mechanics working, and that you're going like, must have a cigar
and
joke now.
You're going to test this. Are there any notes in front of me? Have I written any of this down?
Have we ever met before, sir?
Nothing up my sleeve.
I am. That's why I'm legitimately impressed, because I thought you guys had like a whole shtick worked out, and you know, like there's cue cards.
No, it's then like, the show would be funny. If we did that, the show would be funny.
Shut up. I'm laughing. And I have no voice.
That's true.
Before we got out of here, I just want to take a moment. I mean, I want to really thank Joe for being here.
Oh my gosh. This is the first time we have had someone we have done an entire episode on actually be on an episode.
And
I'm honored.
And I wanted to spend a quick minute to mention, hey guys, many of you who listen to this go to festivals. You go to film festivals, and Mayhem is going to be playing some festivals, and dear God, get out and see Mayhem.
And we're joined by Inga, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. We're your favorite character in the movie.
I'm hoping to God it gets picked up, but it is somebody's going to pick it up. I guarantee you.
In the bargain bin for $3.49.
It is a movie that is that he made for you guys. Like I have talked about, you know, this retro electro, scores that I love, you know, called Outrun right now. Joe scored almost the entire movie with it. And who did you have do it? It was
Steve Moore from the, quintessential electronic band, Zombie, which if you guys don't know, Zombie, you need to listen to him. Cause it's like if Tangerine Dream, was anally raping John Carpenter.
So,
you know, but in a beautiful way. So actually they were making love with a dildo, I would say.
Creepers. So it's Steven Yeun from The Walking Dead.
Yep.
And it's Samara Weaving, who is Hugo Weaving's niece.
Yep.
And they're trapped.
That's actually on her IMDb. Like that's a credit.
Most known for, and it just has a picture of Hugo Weaving.
No, she's actually in, she was in, the last, third of Ash versus Evil Dead, the first season.
Oh, okay, cool.
And she's fantastic in that. She's in McGee's new movie called The Babysitter. She plays the babysitter.
Oh, look at that.
But yeah, she's an up and coming actress, and she's fucking fantastic in this movie.
And it is a pulse pounding, ultra violent, hilarious, fun romp of a violent movie, and it is.
I'm taking that as a fucking quote poll right now.
Go for it, dude. Fucking go for it.
And if I may, let Cargill rest his arm and take over the hand job. Also, listen to the Movie Crypt, which is a podcast that you were nice enough to have Cargill on.
Yes.
Even though all the restraining orders said you shouldn't have, and gave us a nice little plug in the process.
Absolutely,
so we very much appreciate it.
I've been a fan of this podcast for a long time. So. If anything,
I didn't believe him when he told me that.
It's true.
Thank God you did that episode for proof.
I am a connoisseur of podcasts, like, because I hate my family so much. I just sit in my car for 8 hours and just listen to everybody else tell me really funny stories and how great their lives are. Like, I could do a podcast in my house. I live the life. Yeah, I got your fucking score now.
No. why you gotta come after me?
I don't know. You're an easy target. You look so sexy on that couch.
But it's
the appreciation that you guys have for all shapes and forms of film and all the films that I love. It's like, you know, one of the things that we tried to strive for on Movie Crypt, you know, and most of the time it's other filmmakers, other artists. We just want to have a forum. We just want to have a conversation. It's not a junket. It's not, you know, questions and answers and stuff. And what you guys do, which is so great, is that it feels like an extension of just hanging out on the porch and Freaked comes up. And the next thing you know, 45 minutes has gone by and we've all basically done a thesis report on Alex Winter's Freaked.
Which, by the way, I keep mentioning because we will do an episode on Freaked eventually.
Take a drink.
You have to.
I fucking adore that.
But honestly, guys, it's, you know, again, like I said, I've gotten about 6 or 7 hours of sleep since I've gotten here. You've been an amazing host, and you not so much, but a good podcast host.
Yeah.
But this has been one of the best weeks of my life, and being in Austin again, showing my new film has been electrifying, and to cap it all off, I get to be on one of my favorite podcasts. I mean, come on.
Well, thank you.
That's the experience,
man. Oh, we were being so nice to you.
And now that was the Handjob podcast.
I'm really glad that
Dutch Rudders all around. Creepers. Brian, what is this week's junk food pairing?
Well, like I said, I'm glad that we were nice to Joe, because this week's junk food pairing is extremely special in that I am now going to torture both of my co-hosts by actually having them taste this week's junk food pairing.
Sounds like he's come prepared.
I was going to go with a limoncello because, as you know, because giallo, jello sounds alike. And as you know, or maybe don't know, the word giallo is Italian for yellow because the pulp novels that they were based on would often yellow because of the cheap paper they were printed on. Hence, giallo sounds like jello, yellow. You know.
Can you make it with limoncello?
You probably can
make
it.
Could you have limoncello, limoncello?
You probably could. You probably could. But then I remembered an early scene in this movie that hints ever so slightly at the bug nutsery that is in store for you when Jennifer Connelly arrives at the school.
Oh, God.
And she is hungry. And there is nothing to eat in this entire school. But she thinks nothing of cracking open a jar of... Jess, in the peanut gallery, would you mind bringing me a couple spoons, please? She thinks nothing of cracking open a little jar of baby food left over from her roommate's family visit where her little brother was there. So she pulls up a big jar of mixed vegetable baby food. Actually have for us.
Oh, God damn it.
A small tub of, and this is because I've been spending a lot of time in baby stores lately.
I don't want to know the context.
Creepers. Because, you know what, I should probably say because I'm going to have one.
Oh, God damn it, it's all separated?
Yeah, oh yeah. So I've heard that eating baby food as an adult is one of the worst things in the world, and they do it at showers all the time.
No.
It's not?
The guy from RoboCop was very happy when he stuck his finger in the paste and went, baby food.
If you guys are brave enough.
I'll do it.
All right.
I'll fucking do it. Come on.
Joe's all about it.
You know what's gonna? I'm gonna be that guy in RoboCop who's gonna be singing right, the rest of the scene.
I will too, just so it's not just.
Could I mix?
I would otherwise do it. Like I didn't want to make a thing about it, but I'm on a super specific diet right now, so there's.
This is mixed vegetables. Very healthy.
There's only about a dozen vegetables I'm allowed to eat right now, and if
they're probably all
else,
in here.
Throw me out of ketosis.
All right, here we go. Ready.
This was the best week.
That is delicious pus. Because it looks like pus.
Yeah, and I actually got the mixed vegetable flavor. Oh, thank you for handing me the spoon, Cargill. Mm. You sidelining bastard, you. All right, I did this to myself, so I have no reason to complain.
Dude, if you brought creamed cauliflower, creamed broccoli, creamed spinach,
Oh my God.
It's like a special blend of blandness.
It's like I like Campbell's, but I wish it was mealier. You know, I wish it had more of a grit to it, like I was eating sand.
That's the thing. It's kind of like nothing.
Yeah.
It's like a smoothie made by a guy who just quit and just said, fuck it. You know what? You're going to get nothing in this and like it.
This was the worst idea I've ever had, and we've been doing this podcast for 3 years.
I'm glad I shared that with you.
In fact, I think this might be the anniversary now that I think about it. Because it's mid-March, literally. Yeah, this is the 3-year anniversary.
And of all things, we're doing it on Pi Day.
We're doing it on Pi Day, and I'm not eating pie. I'm eating fucking baby food with Joe Lynch. I think my universe is about to collapse a little bit, but this has been a very special episode. So, Joe, while you prepare to regurgitate everything that we just put in you, not just the baby food, but take that for what it's
worth.
Where
can we find you?
Yes.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at the Joe Lynch. Also, listen to the podcast. It's at Movie Crypt because some asshole took at the Movie Crypt.
Dick.
I know. And check out Wrong Turn 2, which is having its 10-year anniversary. When is this going down?
This week.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the Chattanooga Film Festival that's happening in April. If anybody is in Tennessee or wants to drive boat to Tennessee, the Chattanooga Film Festival is an amazing lineup of movies. But what they're doing, which is really cool, is we're going to show the 10-year anniversary of Wrong Turn 2
and
Hatchet. And we're going to be doing a live episode of the Movie Crypt at the festival. And if all goes well, I'm knocking on wood, we're going to have a hell of a guest. It's going to be good. Someone might get punched out, and that's a hint.
Ooh.
Yes.
Ooh.
Is there any chance that Mayhem would play?
TBD.
Mayhaps.
I'm actually working on that right now.
He's emailing as we're talking.
Furiously networking.
I have to tell you this, Joe. Wrong Turn 2 was actually the opening night film of the very first Fantastic Fest that I ever went to, leading up to me moving here. So really? I have a very special affinity for Wrong Turn 2.
He was there at that screening with us.
All right, you were there for the fart.
Yes.
So, yeah, for those who don't know...
We've come a long way.
What you have to understand, this particular screening has a lot of resonance for all of us.
It's kind of where we all formed.
Yeah, because you and I had become friends at a convention, and we were sitting together, and the head of Fantastic Fest pulled me out halfway through the movie to go do the very worst Q&A of my life.
For Flight of the Living Dead.
Sorry,
I had to out you on that one.
No, that's fine. No. I will talk about that publicly.
If you saw Wrong Turn 2, which you did, and thank you very much, there's a scene in the movie where the survivors or the reality show contestants, not knowing yet that they're going to be destroyed by a bunch of mutant hillbilly cannibals, are around a campfire, and there just happens to be barbecue around. So they start eating it, and then they find out that they're eating American Idol contestant Kimberly Caldwell's leg. So, of course, in true Alamo Drafthouse fashion, immediately while everyone's eating in the movie, they start handing out chunks of meat, which is that's fantastic. You know, I think I was the one who coined that because I was like, holy shit, this is actually happening. And then afterwards, we did the Q&A. Now, I had been sitting there, and this was my first Fantastic Fest, so I did not moderate my food and beer intake, realizing that I had a 30-minute Q&A coming up. So, lo and behold, Scott Weinberg brings me up, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was a little bit, a little bit buzzed. I decided to use that opportunity to make my grand introduction to Fantastic Fest by blowing an epic fart into the microphone, and it was glorious. You can find it on the internet. And it was so glorious that the next day Tim Lee came up to me, and you would think he'd be pissed, but he was just like, we got to throw out that mic, right? Like, and Cargill said it, best last night. He's like, they should have bronzed it. Like that should have happened.
Hey Joe. That may be the best answer to where can people find you on the internet that I've ever heard. I don't think you want them to find that particular thing on the internet.
No, I do want them to find that, because that video is that's
the real Joe.
That's it's a distilled version of Joe.
Yeah. Distilled indeed.
Yes.
It's owed to Joe.
Yeah. The Fantastic Fest where I met this fucker and we became friends, and now we're doing this podcast
together. That's what I'm talking about. Like your first night, you were at a screen. We all three of us were at the same screening that you were at on your first day of Fantastic Fest.
Welcome to the Nexus.
It's kind of like that opening scene in Ronin where they all just happen to be in the bar and it all comes together. So we're going to be getting into a car chase very momentarily.
With a monkey. Please say with a monkey.
With a monkey.
Yeah. Yes, with a monkey.
And Jean Reno.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, then you can find me on the internet.
I was just about to ask.
I know, at Massaworm on Twitter, MASSAWYRM, or Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
I met this Twitter troll with the blackest soul. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also, my Facebook page is facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, and follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema Podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. If you really like the show and you would like to see it continue and you would like me to be able to eat things other than baby food, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema would be a great way to contribute.
Where you get bonus episodes.
Bonus!
Like tonight, where the three of us are going to do this week's Junk Food a la Mode about a little film called Logan.
Logan! Oh, I'm so excited for that. Oh, that's going to be great. Never has there been a better time to be a patron. So, folks, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. Whether you're watching Creepers, whether you're watching Phenomena, just always remember that Donald Pleasance in a wheelchair with a monkey helper companion is this week's hot sitcom.